This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Right, hello New Zealand. Welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name's Mark Pacey from the Wairarapa Archive. Today I'm bringing you through three more stories from our past. But three very diverse ones here. Today it is one of the best hotels in Wairarapa, but a century ago this was not the case. This is the unflattering wartime history of the Royal Hotel in Featherston. With the influx of large amounts of men into Featherston area during the First World War, the hotels of that town saw a huge uptake in trade. As many of their men would be spending a lot of time at these hotels, the New Zealand Forces sent an officer to look over the hotels and the facilities and report back. The Empire Hotel in Featherston received a good report. The Tauhere Nikau Hotel had some improvements that needed to be made for the numbers of troops that would be visiting, but also received a reasonable report. The Royal Hotel was not so fortunate. This first report was just the beginning of a series of unfortunate events that would plague the hotel during wartime. Provost Marshal Jameson, the officer who made the inspection, didn't hold back. "I had some difficulty in finding the urinal at this hotel. I eventually located it over 40 yards from the hotel, tucked away in a corner almost hidden from view by a small building. There is no water in connection with this latrine except from spouting on the roof during rain. And, most damning of all, I could not find any lighting arrangements. The drainage is very bad, inasmuch as soldiers must stand on a floor wet with urine. I consider the closets," which for those who don't know is a water closet, is an early name for a toilet, "to be relics of a bygone day and a disgrace to a modern town. The hotel was threatened by the health department getting involved. If they did not upgrade their facilities, and not wanting to lose their patrons, the hotel complied. By the end of 1916, the officers of the New Zealand Forces in Featherston were starting to grow impatient with the Royal. The Featherston Camp Commandant Adams decided to write a letter to the licensing committee. Too many of his soldiers were coming back to camp drunk and were being supplied with alcohol well after the agreed trading hours. He made his threats quite clear. This hotel has been, from my point of view, most unsatisfactorily run. I have power under the war regulations to put this hotel out of bounds for 3 months. I have considerable trouble with this hotel, more so than all the other hotels put together." He was reluctant to act, knowing that if he did, he would be punishing all for the actions of a few. The Royal also had accommodation for the families of men in the camp, and if the hotel was made out of bounds, they would not be able to stay there. But the hotel got the message. They tightened up their rules and were allowed to continue to trade with the military camp. But the bad behaviour of the young soldiers was far from over. In November of 1917, just after 10 p.m, a group of soldiers, reported to be as many as 100, decided they wanted to get back into the Royal Hotel to keep drinking. Two police constables, McLeod and Chapman, were on duty and had the unenviable task of blocking the way between the hotel and this large group of angry men. One of the soldiers, Walter Ross, took things to the next level when he rushed forward, punched Chapman, and then ducked back into the crowd to avoid being caught. He then started to rile up the crowd, saying, "Come on, boys, give it to them. Put the boot in." Fellow angry soldier Private James Duncan continued, "Come on, West Coasters, they can't arrest all of us." It was enough. The crowd attacked the two police officers, who continued to stand their ground against the mob. Eventually, two military policemen arrived and helped disperse the crowd. As there were so many soldiers, no arrests were made. But not all would go unpunished. Ross had been witnessed by several people at the scene. His accomplice, Private Duncan, was not only seen, as well as just before his West Coaster speech, he had yelled, "I am Private Duncan." There was no questioning of his identity. Privates Ross and Duncan didn't get to stay free for long. Just 4 days after the incident, both men were found guilty and sentenced to 3 months' imprisonment each. The military justice system at the time was very efficient. The following year, the hotel keeper at the Royal was fined £1, the equivalent of $130, for supplying a bottle of spirits to a soldier after 6 p.m. In December of 1917, the government had introduced the 6 p.m. closing, the 6 o'clock swill, to try and curb soldier drinking behaviour. In November, the war ended and Featherstone began to clear of soldiers. But the legacy of their behaviour would be felt for years to come. The 6 o'clock closing would remain in effect for a further 50 years. In the years after the war, the Royal Hotel earned a better reputation. With the rowdy soldiers now gone and the facilities upgraded, the hotel hosts socials for residents and groups. Today, the Royal has little in common with its wartime former self, offering fine dining, functions, live music and weddings, and pristine bathroom facilities. Well, I wanted to, I've tried to go back to playing the music that relates to the stories. And really, when you're thinking about, you know, stories about drinking, one really, at least to me, one springs to mind. This is Slim Dusty doing Duncan.
I love to have a beer with Duncan. I love to have a beer with Duncan. We drink in moderation, and we never, ever, ever get rolling drunk. We drink at the town and country, where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Duncan, 'cause Duncan's me mate, yeah. I love to have a beer with Colin. I love to have a beer with Colin. We drink in moderation, and it doesn't really matter if he brings his doll. We drink at the town and country, where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Colin, 'cause Colin's me mate. I love to have a beer with Kevin. Oh, I love to have a beer with Kev. We drink in moderation, and he drives me home in his big old ship. We drink at the town and country, where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Kevin, 'cause Kevin's me mate. I love to have a beer with Patrick. I love to have a beer with Pat. We drink in moderation, and it wouldn't really matter if the beer was flat. We drink at the town and country, where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Patrick, 'cause Patrick's me mate. Change key. I love to have a beer with Robert. I love to have a beer with Bob. We drink in moderation, just one more and back on the job. We drink at the town and country, where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Robert, 'cause Robert's me mate. I love to have a beer with Duncan. Oh, I love to have a beer with Duncan. We drink in moderation, and we never, ever, ever get rolling drunk. We drink at the town and country, where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Duncan, 'cause Duncan's me mate. I love to have a beer with Duncan, 'cause Duncan's me mate.
That's an awesome song. I grew up hearing that. I think I've still got Dad's 45 somewhere of that particular song. All right, next one. In 1963, Japan was preparing for the Olympic Games. In Masterton, two Japanese were demonstrating skills of a different kind. This is the story of the mutton specialist Hisako Arai. The world was warming to Japan in the early 1960s. Tokyo had been chosen to host the 1964 Games, and Westerners were starting to travel to Japan in greater numbers. Japanese people were also traveling and visiting countries all over the world. In early 1963, Hisako Arai, whose title was Chief Television Demonstrator for Japan for New Zealand Meat Producers Board. That's all one title. And her assistant, Misako Ueda, were in Japan. They were in New Zealand. They were demonstrating ways of cooking mutton for members of the Japan Society and to representatives of the Meat Board in Wellington, who had sponsored their visit. The cooking classes were popular, and they were asked to travel about the country to show alternative ways to enjoy mutton with a Japanese twist. Masterton was to be one of the stops, and on July 16, the two women arrived. As the evening closed in, 200 people that the newspaper described as members of various Wairarapa women's organisations and their husbands filed into the Masterton Town Hall. Mayor Tankersley welcomed the two Japanese women to Masterton and settled in to watch the show. Mrs. Arai, who spoke no English, explained first some of the methods of preparing and cooking mutton, her assistant, Miss Ueda, translating. Mutton was sliced very thinly, she explained, and cooked in various ways. Because the meat was so narrow, it cooked much faster than the traditional roasts that New Zealanders were used to. It was explained that in Japan, they mainly used cooking plates to prepare their meals and didn't have the ovens that are the staple of the Kiwi kitchen. The rest of the ingredients were then described. Some of the audiences knew, others were entirely new. Peanuts, onions and peppers were familiar to those in attendance, but the likes of ginger juice and rice wine were something a bit different. The meat and vegetables were all cooked together and served with rice. Alternatives for some of the more exotic ingredients were suggested, including using regular wine in place of the rice wine. Over the course of the night, several dishes were demonstrated, which included chabo chabo, a name derived from the sound mutton makes when it's placed into boiling water, and the very Japanese-sounding fried mutton with peanuts. Those in attendance also got to hear about what it was like living in Japan, less than 2 decades after the end of the war. The cities were becoming very westernized, Arai explained, and meat was something of a luxury item. Rice was the main component of most residents' diets. New Zealand mutton was now being shipped to Japan and was becoming very popular, especially with younger people, as it was priced quite reasonably. Older people, Arai said, tended not to eat meat. The Wairarapa winter was also not a big issue to the two women who were used to the cold Japanese weather. At home in Japan, the winter is even colder than this. Snow falls in the city streets, and in comparison, it is much colder than we have felt here so far, Arai explained. The Japanese women were quite taken by Wairarapa and the rest of New Zealand. Arai was especially taken by the kind hospitality shown to her during her time spent here, and will remember her visit fondly, describing New Zealand as a very friendly country. And for those who are interested, here is Hisako Arai's fried mutton with peanuts recipe. So for the ingredients, we need 3/4 of a pound of mutton, thinly sliced, 1 tablespoon of ginger juice, 1 tablespoon of rice wine, 2 tablespoons of soy sauce, 6 tablespoons of corn flour, 1 egg yolk, 10 ounces of chopped peanuts and frying oil. So we cut the mutton into thin slices and we marinate in the ginger juice, rice wine and soy sauce for 10 minutes. Then you dust the meat with corn flour, dip it in the egg yolk and sprinkle it with chopped peanuts and fry. I have made this. It actually is quite nice. Once I'd finished writing this story, I was, that sounds okay. So I made it that night and it was actually very nice. It is hard to keep the peanuts, the little chopped up peanuts, stuck to the meat. They then tend to stick to the pan. So just be aware of that one if you want to make it. In terms of Japanese music, I would normally play one of my favourite bands, X Japan, but I'm going back in time with this one as well. This is also one of Dad's favourite songs. I have played this before. This is Mr. Kayu Sakamoto doing Sukiyaki.
Hitori pochi no yoru いてあるこう涙がこぼれないように泣きながら
reading the lyrics, the translated lyrics as they came up. That sounds like a really upbeat song, right? You know, all the whistling and everything. Yeah, he's talking about how he's alone and how he's depressed and how he looks up at the stars at night so the tears don't fall out of his eyes. Yeah, interesting. Anyway, on to our last story. In Masterton, on October 19, 1963, two generals directed their troops in battle, and over the course of the campaign, many fell and had to be evacuated on stretchers. This is the story of the epic battle that was Golden Games Chess. The Golden Games officially opened at 2 p.m. on October 19 when transatlantic and Himalayan hero Peter Mulgrew lit the flame. Mulgrew had suffered greatly on his last expedition to the Himalayas, which resulted in both his feet being amputated due to severe frostbite. The Golden Games were a celebration of a wide variety of sporting endeavours, which included events synonymous with big sporting events like gymnastics, swimming, weightlifting and boxing. Some of the more unusual sports included tug-of-war, marching, highland dancing and surfing. But there were truly unique events that had not really been much in the way of big sporting games, model aeroplanes, ballroom dancing, pipe bands, and chess. Of all the events at the game, the one that would not traditionally attract an audience would be chess. Two opponents facing each other over a table, their brows furrowed as they contemplate each move, then picking up and placing a small playing piece, only to place it a short distance away, doesn't make for the best spectator sport. Would also be very hard for an audience to see what was going on, but organisers of the Golden Games had a bright idea of how to make it a bit more interesting and far more exciting. For every move made by one of the masters, the same move would be made by a live playing piece. The floor of the War Memorial Stadium was laid out with a large checkered playing board, and the pieces were assembled and costumed by the Masterton Chess Club. The troops were commanded by New Zealand chess master Rodney Phillips and Ortwin Sarapu. Each time they made a move, they wrote it down and the message was taken to the battleground, and the active chess piece made the same move. Sometimes they shifted to a safe square and lived to play another move, but other times, if they were unlucky, they were killed by one of the enemy pieces. As the valiant troops fell to the ground, they lay there and moved no more. Out from the edges of the battleground ran two brave stretcher-bearers, rushing to the victim's side. These were trained professionals from St. John who had volunteered their services should they be needed. As each piece was carried away, their lifeless forms splayed on the canvas stretchers, the battle continued on. After 45 minutes, the two commanders called a truce. The battle had gone on long enough, and the results were not compelling enough to warrant further conflict, at least for that round. From the perimeters, the St. John staff performed a miracle, and all of the dead and dying pieces miraculously recovered. But as with good soldiers, they immediately returned to the battle. The second campaign went well for Sarapu, but very badly for Phillips. The tide had turned, and again the pieces fell on the battlefield, their remains carried away to clear the space for the conflict to play out. Just 15 minutes after the battle had begun, the war was over. Sarapu, a 7-time New Zealand champion, had won. In the aftermath of the battle, a memorial service for fallen pieces was called off, after they again all made a miraculous recovery. And despite the dry nature of the standard chess game, this event was well attended and enjoyed by all of those that bore witness to the Battle of the Golden Games Chess Masters. All right, time for our last piece of music. Again, it's one of my soundtrack ones, not Hans Zimmer. This is Thomas Newman from the 1917 soundtrack. This is The Night Window. That's that. I do have a joke. I actually, the one I'm looking at now is terrible. I'm not even going to say it. I'll say another one instead. What did the pirate chess piece ask for when he'd finished his meal at the restaurant? Checkmatey. Seriously, that was the better one. The one I actually had was even worse. I'm not even going to say that one. So, yes, there is a worse one than checkmatey. So that is me done for the day. I think I'm here Monday. No, Monday's a holiday, isn't it? Isn't that the one that's carried over from Anzac Day? So I will not see you Monday. We will catch up with you in 2 weeks' time. It is right, isn't it? And Anzac Day is not on Friday. It's the carry forward. So, yeah, Monday. So we'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks. I'll use the time to try and find a better joke, because that was very bad. Look after yourselves. If you're going out, check the weather. It looks like it's getting dark, so maybe take a brolly or a coat. And we'll catch up with you in 2 weeks' time. Have a good one.